All right. Next case on the court's Zoom calendar this morning is State v. Weston. We are ready for arguments from appellant's attorney. Would you please introduce yourself for the record before beginning?
Yes, thank you. My name is Paul Maravili. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Anthony Weston. This appeal raises three issues challenging Mr. Weston's convictions. First, that the threats of violence statute did not apply to the evidence presented on the assault committed in the bedroom, namely, that the act of grabbing or displaying the gun in the backpack did not constitute a threat of violence, which State v. Murphy expressly limited only to threats of future violence. Secondly, that the third degree assault conviction was a necessarily included offense with the domestic assault strangulation conviction under 609.04, based on the elements. Third, there was no valid waiver of counsel in this case due to the district court's erroneous advisory on 611.21 funding and services, which thereby prevented Mr. Weston from making an intelligent waiver. On the first issue, I would submit that in the record, the best evidence that this offense, as described in the evidence, involved a threat of immediate harm was the testimony and the described reaction of the victim herself, Ms. Nemo, by saying, "Are you going to kill me and leave me here like that?" And that she thought he was really going to kill her at that time, on page 225 of the transcript. Though only circumstantial evidence under the applicable standard of review, in this case, I would argue that is the best evidence of the intent held by Mr. Weston, the reaction that it caused. I would stress that under Murphy, the Supreme Court stated that the threats of violence statute, quote, mandates that the threats must be to commit a future crime of violence, unquote, at page 916. This opinion did not allow for any gray area or bleed over between the statutes as I read it and interpret it myself. They describe distinct acts. In my brief, and here I will say that the State v. Smith case does analyze this very issue and found that the threats of violence charge could not be an assault because, despite the fact that that defendant was waving a knife, in other words, displaying a weapon as was alleged in this case, it was accompanied by money demands. See, in this case, it seems that the complaint that Mr. Weston had was the loss of drugs, which were very valuable, worth a lot of money. But there were no statements alleged to have been made about, "Give me the money back or else replace the drugs or else." It was simply the display of a weapon. So that's why.
Mr. Marville, if I'm sorry for interrupting, but is it appellant's position that there has to be, I mean, it's not a quid pro quo, but kind of if you don't do this, then I will engage in a crime of violence against you? I mean, do you need kind of two parts, or can it just be threatening conduct in and of itself?
It under Murphy, it can just be the type of threatening conduct. I am not, to answer your question, arguing that there's a specific checklist applicable here. I mean, for example, in Murphy, the defendant never said a thing. You know, he just, I believe he just left the dead animals on the lawn. I mean, viewed from a neutral perspective, that causes fear. And it seems like it could have gone either way there, that maybe it was a threat of immediate harm, but no, the Supreme Court said it was different. I think what I'm arguing here is that this case just indicated actions consistent with other case law I've cited that conveys an immediate threat. It's more like the absence of what was said in Smith is what is applicable here. You know, not that anything necessarily had to be included. And that is why I did cite, and I'm relying on, the cases in my brief of Kastner and Patton, which all involved the display of a weapon only. No accompanying warnings or else statements. They said that made it an assault because that act in itself is a threat of immediate harm. And the Kastner court even describes such an action as imminently dangerous to display a weapon at page 275. So that is, in a nutshell, the argument that I've made on that issue in this appeal. On the included offense, now, I did not actually find a case that expressly called third degree assault an included offense of domestic assault strangulation, but I did specifically note, you know, the two cases that described what substantial bodily harm is. I'm relying on State v. Jarvis from the Supreme Court in 2003, which, you know, defined impedes or impairs. Anything that impedes or impairs the function of a bodily organ can be substantial bodily harm. And the welfare of CAG decision by this court in 2017 found that exactly, that any act of strangulation constitutes substantial bodily harm because it impedes the airway through the trachea or the larynx. Mr.
Maravilli, if I could just stop you for a second. The law is clear from Bertsch that we look at the elements, not the facts. And where I struggle with your argument on this case is you're arguing the facts and not the elements, because I think we all agree that substantial bodily harm and third degree assault isn't an element of domestic assault strangulation. So that's where I'm having a hard time with this argument, is that you're not arguing the elements, you're arguing the facts of those various cases. And that seems to be a fact issue for the jury to determine, not for this court to determine. And that's why we have Bertsch that says, don't get into the facts. Look at the elements to see if it's an included offense. Help me here.
Well, Your Honor, on that, I can't disagree at all. I can only point out that this does appear to be something of an issue of first impression. But again, I don't see how what you just said is possible, and then to have permitted, you know, the ruling in CAG. I mean, you know, why was the CAG court having to say that strangulation is substantial bodily harm? Unfortunately, the legislature did not, you know, define what strangulation is in a broader sense. So in this case, the element of strangulation, if for no other reason than the Jarvis and the CAG case I'm citing, must necessarily include it.
Counsel,
yes.
On that point, so third degree assault requires substantial bodily harm. Substantial bodily harm is defined to include a temporary but substantial loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ. So we would, to accept your argument, we'd essentially have to conclude that any strangulation results in a substantial loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ. Yes?
Any strangulation that impedes the flow of air, yes. Or,
all right, but strangulation is defined as impeding normal breathing or circulation of the blood by applying pressure on the throat or neck, or by blocking the nose or mouth. So under that definition, you could strangle somebody by covering their mouth so they couldn't breathe out of their mouth, and it doesn't matter that they could nonetheless breathe out of their nose. So under those circumstances, how would we say as a matter of law there was a substantial loss of the function of any bodily organ?
All I can say is that if I were the trial attorney at the district court, you know, I would be looking at the definition of strangulation as it is in the statute, which I'm sorry, I don't have in front of me right now, but it does make the same definition about impeding the airway. So I would question, you know,
right,
upholding.
My question is, it does define it as impeding, but is every strangulation as defined a substantial impediment?
And I'm arguing that it has to be, again, because of the analysis in Welfare of CAG, because, you know, the interruption of airflow or blood flow, if the strangulation is intense enough, it is a substantial and temporary interruption of the function of a bodily organ.
And what is the site to CAG, please?
2017 Westlaw, 358-5125.
So it's an unpublished case.
It is.
All right,
as
so
I said, I'm sorry, the authority on this was difficult to find, and it just so happened that Welfare of CAG commented specifically on this, but yes, it is non-precedential.
Precedential. Thank you.
I would just follow up by adding that in this case, there was the additional fact put in that, you know, Ms. Nemo heard a cracking sound, which, you know, if it involved cracking cartilage, you know, that was also found to be substantial bodily harm in State v. Larson from this court in 1987 at the 413 Northwest 2nd. Finally, that the Bowles decision, also non-precedential from 2016, nevertheless pointed out what I think is a well-understood point of law, that loss of consciousness is not necessary for strangulation to amount to, you know, a felony and substantial bodily harm. Well, finally, I will move on to the waiver of counsel issue. It is actually a two-pronged argument. I neglected to mention the first one in my opening statement. Essentially, I'm saying that I do not believe the record demonstrates that the district court properly considered whether Mr. Weston had adequate opportunity to consult with counsel. And I'm relying conceitedly primarily on the Garibaldi case, which, of course, found an invalid waiver because, you know, the defendant and his lawyer, I don't know if it was appointed or not, had no meaningful interactions. The lawyer took no definitive steps towards representing him, like, you know, bringing motions and such. And that is essentially what happened in this case, that Mr. Weston had public defenders along the way. But on April 27th, that appointed attorney just announced that they were waiving all omnibus issues and no other issues were raised. There was also the matter of the attorney saying that on that date, he had discussed with Mr. Weston about how his cases, plural, were moving or could move forward. I just don't think that's specific enough. You know, at the time, Mr. Weston had three pending cases. It just wasn't made clear that, you know, the felony terroristic or threats of violence and domestic assault was the one that was ever discussed. So I think under Garibaldi and the other cases I cite in my brief, that the district court's inquiry was not adequate on that aspect of a valid waiver. And then secondly, I'm raising what I'm feeling pretty certain is probably another issue of first impression here. And that is whether pro se defendants are entitled to 611.21 funding and services. And then I suppose the next question is whether they can be properly denied, as the district court did in this case. I'm relying heavily on the written petition that was submitted, you know, which case law says is the best practice. If a defendant is going to waive counsel, the district court should get it in writing, and it was. But I emphasize that the petition says to proceed as pro se counsel. And that's exactly what he was doing. And that's the same word used in 611.21, counsel. The statute never mentions the word attorney. And the district court kept using that word. I mean, she even called Mr. Weston at one point being his own attorney. Well, Mr. Weston is not an attorney.
You know, Mr. Maravelli, though, I'm struggling with the way you frame this issue, because no one's challenging the denial of the motion. You're challenging the waiver of his right to counsel. And that occurred a month before this came through. I mean, wouldn't this if that was the issue you wanted to raise, wouldn't have been brought more squarely before us by challenging that denial as opposed to the validity of the waiver?
Well, Your Honor, my recollection of the record was that at the point when Mr. Weston was requesting the services, it was after immediately after he had waived counsel. He had submitted his petition out of court in writing. So this appearance where the 611-21 came up was at the next appearance. So you are correct that they weren't contemporaneous, but he managed to file the motion himself outside of court several days before the hearing, as I recall.
All right. And Judge Larkin, I know we're over time here, but I have one other question on this issue. If
you may,
if Mr. Maravilla will help me here. I'm looking at the motion. I got it in front of me here, Mr. Maravilla. You're right. He mentions three different file numbers, and then he says he needs an expert witness, investigator, and transcripts. I need an investigator to see if similar drivers were stopped by Officer Hansen. Must be a different case. This wasn't a stop issue.
It is.
I need an expert opinion to retest the controlled substances. Again, an unrelated case. There's not a controlled substance crime here. And I need a copy of my transcripts. The district court judge even said she's confused by this because it doesn't even seem to apply to the case that is here on appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. I just remember specifically that Mr. Weston also pointed out that he was asking for the expert to deal with the nature of the injuries in the threats of violence case. It's in the June 9th hearing at page 21. And this was the same hearing where they were discussing 611.21 funding. So I again would say that he made this request as soon as he could, and he did fulfill the statutory requirement of stating a specific grounds for needing the funding. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Yeah, just to clarify on that, that was the interaction where the district court said, well, I mean, it was about the treating physician, right? It wasn't to get a separate exam or separate expert. And didn't the district court say, well, you can subpoena the physician as a witness?
Well, he wouldn't be able to pay. This was an expert witness, Your Honor, and experts have to be paid. And this was, again, during the same discussion about whether
this wasn't the treating physician then.
No, this was his own doctor. He wanted to get another doctor to evaluate.
Okay, got it.
Okay.
All right. Sorry for my confusion.
We'll now hear from the state. Counsel, please introduce herself before proceeding with argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lydia Villalba-Unijo, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing Respondent State of Minnesota. The first argument that I'd like to address is the waiver of counsel and Section 611.21 argument. Mr. Weston's waiver of counsel was valid. There was a written waiver, and there was a thorough in-court waiver on May 19th of 2022. Mr. Weston was represented by two different attorneys for several months, and the record demonstrates that he was advised about representing himself. In addition, Mr. Weston expressed a very strong desire to represent himself, even after being cautioned by the district court that it would be difficult and that he would be held to the same standard as an attorney. I believe that the district court's question to Mr. Weston was, so are you dead set on representing yourself? And he very firmly responded that he was. In contrast to Garibaldi, which is the case that Mr. Weston is relying on, there's a very sharp difference between what occurred in this case and Garibaldi. In Garibaldi, there was no written or in-court waiver. In addition, there's no indication that the defendant in Garibaldi had been advised regarding self-representation. Mr. Garibaldi was represented at one hearing, the first hearing, by private counsel. He informed the district court at the next hearing that there was a fee dispute And so he was no longer being represented by counsel. And he, in fact, was very ambiguous in his discussion with the district court about whether he wanted to proceed to represent himself. So you can see the differences on its face between Garibaldi and Mr. Weston's situation. Now, regarding Mr. Weston's request for services, the plain language of Section 611.21 does not expressly allow self-represented litigants to apply for investigative services. And yesterday, as I was preparing for this argument, I found a non-precedential decision by this court that might be helpful on that particular point. Mr. Marivili, I'm sorry that I didn't bring this up earlier, but I did just find this case yesterday afternoon while preparing. The case is State versus Green. It's appellate file number A180861. Minnesota Court of Appeals case, January 14, 2019. So that might be helpful to this court. But this court doesn't have to resolve that statutory interpretation question about whether the statute applies to pro se litigants, because Mr. Weston did not demonstrate that the services were necessary. In fact, it's not even necessarily clear what precisely he was requesting and why he was requesting it, or why he thought it was necessary for his defense. He first referred to computer access and outdated books, and then later in the hearing, he referred to seeking information about the injury to JN's leg. And I will leave it to the court to review the hearing transcript, but my recollection is that Mr. Weston was referring to JN's doctor, which is what prompted the district court to say, you can subpoena the doctor and have him testify. Now, the court gave Mr. Weston several options. First, she advised that he consult with advisory counsel and resubmit the request. And that would have actually conformed to the language of the statute of 611.21, which includes language that says counsel appointed by the court for an indigent defendant. Mr. Weston had advisory counsel. That advisory counsel was appointed on June 7, 2022. There's an order in the district court file. Second, the district court suggested that Mr. Weston could subpoena JN's doctor to testify regarding her leg injury. And third, the statute itself provided a way for Mr. Weston to appeal the court's decision through an appeal to this court. Mr. Weston didn't pursue any of those remedies. Mr. Weston has also argued that because of the way that the district court denied the services based on the statute not applying to pro se litigants, that it undid or invalidated his waiver. Now, the waiver form advised Mr. Weston that he could request the services. It did not say that he was entitled to those services. And I think the correct number is 17D on the waiver form. And the waiver directed Mr. Weston directly to the statute. So it's possible that if Mr. Weston had submitted the request through his advisory counsel, who was the counsel appointed to him, and if the request had demonstrated that the services were necessary, it is possible in the circumstances here that his request for services may have been granted. The next issue I'd like to address, and I see I'm sorry, are there questions? Okay, I'm sorry, the next issue I'd like to address, because it's a little complicated, at least it was for me, is the included offenses argument. And so Mr. Weston is arguing that the third degree assault conviction should be vacated because strangulation is substantial bodily harm, which is the level of harm that's required for third degree assault. But Mr. Weston's incorrect on this point. Third degree assault and domestic abuse strangulation have different elements, and it's the comparison of the elements and not the facts of the case that determines whether one offense is an included offense of another. The third degree assault does not require that the victim be a member of the defendant's family or household, so that the third degree assault cannot be an included offense of domestic assault strangulation. And on the other hand, a domestic assault strangulation does not require that the strangulation result in substantial bodily harm. A person who commits a domestic abuse strangulation does not necessarily commit a third degree assault. And I would refer the court, again, this was, I guess sometimes as you're preparing for oral argument, your mind sharpens in a different way. So I was reading the Serrano-Santana case yesterday. That's a non-precedential decision of this court from 2021 that discusses the sufficiency of the evidence regarding a domestic abuse strangulation. And it might be, this court might find it relevant here because the appellant in Serrano-Santana was arguing basically for a higher level or for a more severe injury to be established to satisfy the strangulation requirement. And this court discusses the domestic abuse strangulation issue and specifically what is required for strangulation that makes it clear that a strangulation is not necessarily and this is not always a substantial bodily harm. So I would encourage the court to look at that case. But there's one other, I think, important reason why third degree assault cannot be an included offense of domestic abuse strangulation. And that is that there were three injuries here that the state was asserting as substantial bodily harm. So it was not only strangulation. JN also suffered a severe leg injury, and she also suffered an injury to her shoulder. In closing argument, the prosecutor pointed to all three of those injuries and explained to the jury that they could find substantial bodily harm based on any of those injuries. It is clearly the jury found substantial bodily harm here, and it is not clear, we do not know, and nor can we speculate what injury the jury found occurred that satisfied the substantial bodily harm standard. So if this court were to vacate the third degree assault and say that it's an included offense of the domestic abuse strangulation, that would be concerning because it would completely ignore those other two injuries that occurred, and it would also not be legally correct because it's possible that the jury here found that the substantial bodily harm was the leg injury and then also convicted for the domestic abuse strangulation. So that's the main point I wanted to make there on that included offense. And if there aren't any questions, I'll settle down.
All right, I don't see any questions. So we'll hear from Mr. Maravilli. Rebuttal argument, please.
Yes, thank you. I want to try to clear this up more about the physician. I did look at the record. First of all, as I looked through the list of witnesses, the state never actually called a physician at trial. They called a domestic abuse expert, Scott Miller, on the last day of trial, and then the state rested. Secondly, on June 9th, at page 21, Mr. Weston pointed out that the physician he was trying to get was Ms. Nemo's personal physician. And I don't know that he was on any witness list, but either way, to get his opinion, the man would have to be paid. And I do, Judge Flory, want to point out that I did misspeak earlier. I checked the record. The petition to proceed pro se was filed May 15th, and the next hearing was May 19th, where the waiver was covered. But what I just need to add here is that it was at the next appearance, June 9th, where at the start of it, the judge inquired, is it still your intent to proceed pro se at that June 9th hearing? In other words, the judge did not consider the matter finally settled, and it certainly was not finally settled to Mr. Weston, because that's when he made his funding request. So I do maintain it was for an independent outside witness. You know, Ms. Nemo's physician would not have been the person, as far as I know, who examined her if she went to the emergency room. I would respond to counsel's comments about the other part of the waiver by just contrasting the State v. Worthy decision. Again, that was a case where the attorney had actually made several arguments and filed several motions on behalf of the defendant before he was discharged, and that's the contrast here. I would respond to the point about the extent of the injuries here by again pointing to the record. Every injury that Ms. Nemo sustained, the impeding the airflow and blood flow, the crackling cartilage, if that's what it was, and then the leg injury, all were a product of the strangulation. Because as described at trial, when Ms. Nemo was thrown on the bed, it was while she was being held around the neck. So I do believe that in this case, you know, the element of strangulation covered all the injuries. It also involves substantial bodily harm, as I have argued here, the way it's been interpreted and the way it's defined in the statute. And if...
How do you respond to the respondent's argument, well, the jury could have found that it was the leg injury that was the third degree assault?
I would stay with what I just said, that the leg injury was caused by, you know, or during Mr. Weston having had her around the throat. I mean, it would be a different thing if she was struck on the leg, but being thrown the way it was described, resulting in the leg injury, I think is the same thing. The other thing I would say is that, you know, that isn't what was presented to the jury. As far as the substantial bodily harm, as I recall from the record. And even if it is, Your Honor, the level of harm related to that leg injury is still substantial bodily harm, as the strangulation is. So it's a single behavioral incident. It's 609.04, not allowing two convictions for the same act. That's my response.
And if there are no additional questions, the matter is submitted. Thank you for your argument, and you'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.